Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
Hello, and welcome to the Ivy Podcast. My guest today is Rebecca Masiera Kaufman, a seasoned CEO, founding member of the RMK Group, and an author. Hey, Rebecca, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you, Fred?
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for being with us today. Before we start this episode, I have one small request to our listeners. As we continue to grow the Ivy Podcast, we would appreciate if you would take just a minute of your time to leave us a review on the show, because reviews make a huge difference to podcast channels like ours. Now, time for the episode with Rebecca. So, Rebecca, you have a ton of experience as a seasoned CEO and in leading Fortune 500 companies. Please tell us a bit about yourself and your background. How would you describe Rebecca?
Sure. Oh, how would I describe Rebecca? Well, and my background. Well, high energy and passionate, I guess, is how I would describe myself. But my background, I have 30 plus years working. I started off my career internationally, actually in London, doing strategy consulting for a few years. And then I moved back home to San Francisco and started as a product manager in a company called First Deposit that later became Providian Financial and was in customer marketing for a few years. And then moved to Wells Fargo. I stayed at Wells Fargo 13 years. Uh-huh. And ended up running our small business segment. I had about 2 million small business customers. Love that. Love serving small businesses, truly the backbone of our economy. And then from there, I moved to Citi. I was really interested in the international offerings and actually started off at Citi as the president of California, Nevada, and then moved to become the CEO of Banamex USA, a subsidiary uh-huh. with a Mexican bank. I had a lot of cross-border business. And then from there, I did that for 3 years and was also a director of that board. From there, I became chairman of that board of directors, was chairman for 4 years, and then also was head of the International Personal Bank, which is really about international dollar-based wealth management. And we were in serving clients in 100 countries. So very exciting career. And then about a year and a half ago, I decided to move into RMK Group LLC, where I advise startup CEOs, other CEOs or C-suite members, uh-huh. as well as serve on boards of directors. And I serve on a number of boards, and I wrote a book and I speak and write.
That's wonderful. How did you end up in London? What was the reason for you to move to London? And did you enjoy your experience there? I'm curious to know from somebody that's lived here without ever being to the UK.
Sure. Well, I always wanted to do international things, if you will. All through college, I worked abroad in the summers. I worked in Paris. I worked in Helsinki.
Oh, wow.
And then in business school my summer, I worked in Hong Kong. And so after working in French, Finnish, and Cantonese, when I graduated from business school, I thought I really wanted to work in my mother tongue, but abroad. So that's why I chose the UK. I worked in London for 3 years at two different companies. I loved it. I ended up traveling quite a bit, 3 or 4 days a week to France or Finland because I spoke French and Finnish. And so they always put me on French and Finnish clients. So ironically, I didn't end up working entirely in English.
That's wonderful. You already answered. I was going to ask if you spoke the languages, but sounds like you do, which is absolutely fascinating. Now, you're a founding member of the RMK Group, as you alluded to, and there's something fascinating that I saw on your LinkedIn profile that I want you to describe. You mentioned that you focus on a four-pronged approach to business culture. Could you please describe to us these approaches and how they can help companies succeed?
Sure. So I have really taken a four-pronged approach throughout my entire career. And the four prongs, three really don't get adjusted. One depends on the situation. So the four prongs to approaching business and culture is really around client centricity. Second, around employee engagement. Third, around what I'm going to call excellent execution, operations, compliance, controls, delivery. And the fourth pillar is really around shareholder return. And so let's start with client centricity. If we are doing a business for the client, about the client, serving the client, then really we should get most things right, right? Like client is, why we're here. We wouldn't be here if we weren't serving a need for our clients. Employee engagement. Well, we can't serve our clients if our employees aren't hired well, developed well, trained, motivated, inspired, appreciated, appropriately paid, et cetera. So employee engagement, are our employees enjoying the work? Are we doing the right thing? So that's pillar two. Got to be serving our clients, have to make sure our employees are engaged in a really great way. Third is what I call the one that shifts a little bit depending on the business. In general, I call it excellent execution. Mm-hmm. In a regulatory business that I've always been in, highly regulated financial services, it's compliance, controls, you know, maker checker. When you have money, when you work in a place with a lot of money, like banks or financial services, you have to have a lot of controls, dual controls. Operational excellence, you know, depends on, you know, maybe if you're in a distribution business, it's excellent logistics, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really about that excellent execution. And then the fourth pillar, shareholder return. Well, at the end of the day, we have to make a fair return for the capital invested by our shareholders and return to them the correct return on their investment. So those are really, I found throughout my career that has helped us make wise decisions, starting with the customer.
Right. So you said, when you started your answer, you said one of those four changes depends on the situation. Which one is that?
That's the excellent execution, where I say it's operational excellence. It could be regulatory excellence. It could be compliance controls. But I gave you the example for a financial services firm. It's much, much more about compliance controls because of money. But right. In a distribution firm or a delivery business, I talked about logistics as your excellence. I'm saying what the excellent execution is may have a different focus depending on the business.
Got it. Now, follow up to that. We live in a world where a lot has changed the last, 20 to 24 months. Do those four-pronged approaches change based on that? Is there a new approach that you've adopted over the last 20 to 24 months?
I don't think so. Client is still the center. You still have to engage your employees. You have to deliver with excellence. Operationally, compliance, control, legally, that's all the same. And then shareholder return. It's funny, you could say stakeholder return, but I already have the stakeholders in the other pillars, client, employee, your regulatory community. So they really are in there. So I know some people change shareholder return to stakeholder return, but if you think about those pillars, those are the stakeholders, right? Your right. clients, your employees, the legal, regulatory, community, environment.
So I want to transition and let's have us talk about startups. What are some of the biggest differences you see when it comes to advising startups that have extremely high potential as compared to your work with already established Fortune 500 companies?
Yeah, it's very interesting, the question around differences between startups and Fortune 500 companies. I mean, at some level, startups, and again, these are super simplified generalizations, right? But at some level, the startups I work with are very much product led, right? They have an idea and they want to get a product out. And then they're very technology led because often in startups, it's a technology platform or ability that gets that product out there. And then their culture tends to be very agile, nimble, fast to market, and willing to take risks and probably way more chaos than a larger company would be willing to support. Right. See what I mean? So in my Fortune 500 experience and my Fortune 500 clients, I'd say they have very good process orientation, very good metrics and metrics inspection routines, a very clear and articulated culture, with really good people processes, often very good people processes. And their trade-off then, if you think about the trade-off or struggle for a startup is often, how do you get all these people onboarded and when you're scaling and get them into these processes? And when you're the larger company, they tend to be more challenged by speed to market, the agility, mm-hmm. the ability to innovate and get new products out. With the good controls they need because they have more, if you will, money to protect, right? protect. So you get those trade-offs and you see why the two worlds exist and how they end up, one becomes the other, right? I mean, over time.
That leads me to my next question, which is startups, typically they want to become that big, the next big company, right? They want to become an enterprise when they start scaling because they want to have a customer base. They want to establish some brand loyalty. At what point does a startup transition over to become that big company? Now we have to stop operating as a startup now. Now we have to think differently because we're basically wearing different set of shoes compared to what we were wearing in the past. What point do you think that transition happens?
Yeah, it's different for each company. I know they say that, you know, when you're 30 people, you can know everyone. When you're 100, you can still know everyone. When you hit 300, can you know everyone? Mm-hmm. Is the question. And what is that turning point? So starting, often it's at a number of employees that you'll start requiring the people scale, but it could be at 100. For some companies, they're so complex in their geographic diversity of their employee base that they might need that level of people processes at 100 people or 50 people even. It just depends on the complexity of the business. If everyone's doing the exact same job, it might be less complex, but that's not the case in startups. So once you start scaling people, you start scaling your issues. Yeah. And so probably 30, 50, 100, you start needing, you know, even at 30, you start needing really solid people processes. Then at some point along the way, you need really good documentation of your product, your technology. So if you're in test and learn mode, maybe not so much, but once you're rolling it out and going to scale it, then everything starts needing documentation. Once you're going to go into different markets, you need lawyers and good legal counsel for each market to know what the rules are geographically, country. So I think it just depends on what kind of scaling you're doing, but there are things that come. If you're scaling globally, you're going to need a lot more legal support, compliance support to do things legally in each country. If you're scaling in similar jobs, you might be able to scale to 100 before you need as much people process, but gosh, you need people process pretty quickly. Payroll's got to happen on time, right? Benefits. You know that, I'm sure, better than others.
Yeah, correct. And you're actually talking about some of the questions that I had coming up with regards to scaling, which is, you know, maybe sharing some of the recommendations on how to overcome some of the risks that startups face when it comes to scaling up their operations or even expanding to global markets. So you talk about the processes, you talk about hiring the right people. Is there anything else that you could add to that? Because a large base of our listeners are people that are either startup founders or work for startups. So some of these recommendations could be something that they could take and apply on day one or as soon as they listen to the podcast.
Sure. Yeah. So absolutely. So I think there are a number of things that startups can do to scale their own learning curve faster. I advise a number of CEOs, and I'd say most of the startups I work with, they have more than one advisor. So I'm one advisor, but they have other advisors. If they're in a, if they're geographically expanding, I would suggest, you know, for sure getting really good legal counsel locally. So if they're expanding into Africa, Europe, Latin America, Asia, anywhere, you're going to need for each one of those markets by country, not by region, but by country, laws and the regulations are. I think another way to scale is getting advisors. And so some companies have advisory boards, some have advisory councils, some have individual advisors. So a lot of the fintech companies I advise, it's that they want someone who understands scaling globally a regulated financial business. In other startups, if they're in packaged goods, they may want someone that's scaled a packaged good company in multiple areas. So I think advisors are really helpful to that. The board of directors can be extremely helpful if the company has a board. Even investors, you know, having a diverse investor base as a startup, that your investors not only bring money, but bring skill, contacts, know-how. So I think between advisors, board members, and investors, you have a really robust ecosystem that can help founders and CEOs augment their skills in a scalable way with the diversity of those skills. So those are a few things I would suggest.
Yeah, those are wonderful. I've heard some of those from other panelists or the guests that we've had on the podcast, but you have a very different experience, and that's why I thought it would be a good question
sure.
for you.
Now, I'd say that if someone's scaling internationally, the other thing I'd say is go visit that country. And then if you really want to do well there, you're hire your head of sales from that country for that country, because every business is local at some level.
Right.
You know, so there are things you can do in the headquarters, but you're going to need to have local talent. And then I'd say for scaling, the one other thing I'd add that I've seen with my clients is start thinking about your routines. Because if you're going to scale, how are you going to manage to get the culture across everyone and the know-how? So what are the routines? How are you disseminating information, all team meetings, one-on-ones? What metrics do you look at? What inspection routines will you have to make sure that each place you're scaling is achieving it? So those are some of the things. And of course, keep it simple. It's hard to scale if it's complex.
Yeah. Yeah. And thanks for sharing those. So given your vast experience in the banking sector, what are the most recent trends that you believe will dominate the fintech industry over the coming few years? And a follow-up to that is, does cryptocurrency have a role to play in that?
Yes and yes. So let's see. I do think that they often say that to understand the future, look around you today because it's already here somewhere. So absolutely, I think the future is going to have increased digital everything, right? So I think fintech will continue to be a very important space. I also think that there's some really interesting trends around how embedded the financial services are now to the service itself. So a shipping company could become a financial services company. We're seeing that with, you know, an information company has so much information, they become a financial services company. We're seeing everyone, the big companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, all starting to offer ways to pay within their ecosystem. And so I think those will be really interesting trends to see of which ones make it in their own digital currency or the way they set it up. Crypto for sure will be a big part of the future, I believe, plus all the decentralized finance options we're starting to see. And within that, I think we'll see a proliferation of exchanges, on-ramps and off-ramps of going in and out of cryptocurrency, stable coins to fiat, you know, and then how do you go in and out of these spaces, plus increasing regulation around it, plus layers on top of layers of what will speed up these transactions. So what will speed up, for instance, like the Lightning Network on top of Bitcoin or different smart contracts with different assets? How will you now have those assets held, or the custodial services for digital assets may proliferate? So I think there's so many avenues of opportunity. We don't know what it will shake out to be, who the biggest players will be eventually, but I think it's a very interesting time.
Now, there's something that I keep reading about this on different articles or see this in the news. The crypto industry is very, very volatile. As of right now, I don't know if you look at the crypto market, it's taken a kind of a beating over the last week. Do you think that will affect the way commercial banks do their operations? Because they don't tend to deal with a lot of volatility like this. And crypto, people say it's the future. Do you think banks today should change how they operate instead of accepting more crypto, or at least having that as part of their portfolio for their clients?
So, I mean, I think that the volatility is going to continue. So I agree with that statement. Do I think that institutions should allow their clients to hold it? Sure, the volatility won't affect their client if the client knows about the volatility. What the volatility puts at risk is if you do margin on it. So I wouldn't margin a highly volatile asset trading class, because then you'd be making margin calls all the time. And that would go against those four pillars, because it wouldn't be client-centric. You don't want to be calling a client all the time to call a margin, you know, to request money. So I wouldn't particularly think that that would be a common thing a bank would do. I mean, it would not be within the regulatory parameters anyway to have that kind of a volatile asset that you margin I'm sure someone will somewhere, but it's just
anything is possible.
It's not the right. No, and people do it now, but I'm saying it's not the usual risk profile against the bank. So, why you couldn't hold the custodial account for it would be fine. I mean, as long as you, the client, are very well aware that this can go to zero.
Yeah. Buyer beware, right?
You have to be very understanding that this can go to zero. It can go to $1 million too, but it can go to zero. So I think those are, you have to have the right kind of investor that understands the risk.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, if you don't understand that you could lose all your investment and still go into debt, there's a lot of stories out there that people became millionaires, right? Because they invest in this coin and overnight it became a success. But there's a lot of people that we don't hear about that lost all their money. So
sure, Fred, that always makes me so sad, because when you're in the investment field advising clients, there was always historically a group of investments called alternatives. And in a portfolio, one would rarely recommend more than 5% of one's wealth in alternatives. And typically, depending on the level of wealth someone had or their net worth, you wouldn't recommend, you'd have a discussion with them about their risk profile. And let's say they come out and their risk profile is moderate. You ask questions like, could you sleep at night if your portfolio value dropped 30%? If the person says, no, I couldn't, you wouldn't put them in alternative investments. Right. Then you'd have your client, let's say they'd say their risk appetite is aggressive. They want high return and they understand with high return, there's high volatility. Even with that person, you might not put more than 5%. So the moderate, you might put nothing in, or low risk, nothing in alternatives. But for that person that wants aggressive, you might put more. No one should be putting 100% into
something that's volatile as that.
So this losing all your money means you're certainly not diversified, which is rule number one of investing.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk about team building and high-performing teams. Please share with us some of the attributes that you look for when building high-performing teams, particularly at the C level. What does it take to be a part of a high-performing team? And what ways can people prepare themselves to ensure that they're on the right path?
So when building high-performing teams, I would say it's true at all levels, but then I'll tell you what's true of the C-suite. So I'd say at all levels, I look for great attitude and great aptitude. Because what you really want is someone that will motivate and inspire and be a great team member, and also who's smart and can learn and can figure things out. So that's like basic for what I consider a great employee. Depending on the role, I look for experience. You know, they may have great contacts with their experience, and their judgment comes from experience. So then I start for a C level, I start looking for them that's had enough experience to those judgment calls. You want someone who's made mistakes and learn from those mistakes. If someone has never made a mistake, they really will not be a great C-level member, because, you know, stuff hits you all the time that you don't know how to deal with. So you have to have that agile mindset, a learning mindset, and the ability to inspire and motivate and teach, because you're leading a lot of people typically, ability to collaborate, put your ego at the door. And again, I was getting back to that decision-making acumen, that ability to make a judgment and make a call, because a lot of times you do not have all the information. So I look for that ability, that experience of having to make decisions with 70% of the information and those judgment calls, what's worked, what's not worked, and what did they learn from it? So those are some of the things I look for.
You know, I'm going to be honest here. This to me is one of the best reasons why we do the podcast. You talk about people that have failed. You want someone that has failed at doing something and what they learn from that. Because if you've never failed at anything, there's this saying, you know, calm seas never made a skilled sailor, right? So if somebody hasn't been through that battle of making mistakes and learning from it, and they become an executive at a top company, one day they might face a calamity. How are they going to respond to that if that's their first time dealing with that kind of thing? So I'm actually glad you mentioned that, because this is one thing that even I tell people a lot of times, don't be afraid to make mistakes, just make sure you don't repeat them and learn from them. But if you're always squeaky clean, never make any mistakes, eventually it will catch up to you and how you're going to respond.
Yeah, love that phrase, calm seas don't make a seasoned sailor.
Exactly. So now,
Show up, battle-tested people, yes.
Right. I want to talk about your book. So you're an author of the book, Fit CEO, Be the Leader of Your Life. What was the motivation to write it, and what do you hope the readers take away from reading it?
Well, the motivation is my whole career. I had people say to me many, many times, how do you do it? How do you stay really high energy and positive and passionate about work when you're traveling 200, 300,000 miles a year? You're in Singapore 1 week, Moscow the next, you know, Uruguay the next. Coming from San Francisco, those are not easy locations to go to all the time. Right. And people would sometimes stand in line to talk to me after I would give a talk, a business talk at work, or and have all these questions about, you know, you have two kids, you're married, you're, how, you know, you're fit, you have hobbies, you have friends, how do you do all that? And so I really wanted to write a book someday about it. So I did. And the idea behind it was, how could I wanted the book, and my co-author and I together, I can tell you a little bit about that when I met Lillian, but I had wanted to write this book, let's say 20 years. And about 10 years ago, I met Lillian. She was my personal trainer at a club that I was at when I became CEO of Banamex USA. And I was really time strapped. And I was looking for a personal trainer that would meet with me just 30 minutes once or twice a month. And she was in the similar phase of life that was transitioning and willing to do that. And so we met after working together a year. I said, I'm writing this book someday. Do you want to write it with me? And she said, yes. And then fast forward 10 years later, I called her up. I said, okay, I'm ready to write the book. You in? And she said, yes. And we did it. And the idea was, the idea behind the book is that you can be the leader of your life. You can be the CEO and be the leader of your life. You can be an employee and be the leader of your life. You can be at home and be the leader of your life. But there are these concepts around commitment, boundaries, intention, self-care, and heart. Those are the five sections of the book that we give all of our tips and tricks as almost read through the book. It takes about 2.5 hours, or read the 30 chapters, one chapter a day. But each chapter is just about 2.5 pages, very short on a concept, a leadership concept about managing your mental, physical, spiritual, emotional health. And then after I write this concept or I give an example, then Lillian has immediate and imperfect action steps that are just a few bullets. So it's a very, it's almost like a reference book after you've read it to say, oh, I'm going to get on a 16-hour flight. Oh, I'm going to a stressful dinner. Oh, I have to, you know, present. What should I do? Like, it's all about tips and tricks of my 30-year career and her 20-year career.
That's good. So I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that the book's available on Amazon, but where else can people find the book?
The book is available on Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble's digitally, you know, online, Porchlight, Booktopia, bookshop.org. If you go to fitceobook.com, F-I-T-C-E-O-B-O-O-K, fitceobook.com, we list all, you know, many of the digital retailers. And if you want to walk into your local bookstore, they can order one for you. No problem.
That's great. And for our listeners, what we'll do is we'll include the link, the fitceobook.com on the episode notes, so that when you listen to the podcast, you can just click from there. It'll take you directly to her website and you can go ahead and buy the book. Last question, Rebecca, you may have something similar to this listed on your book, but I'm just going to go ahead and ask you, what has helped you get to where you are? And what of advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's similar to yours?
So I think it's mindset. You know, I talked about hiring for attitude and aptitude. So I think it's a mindset of it's half full or it's full. And we get to participate in life, and that you're never too old to dream a new dream or keep filling up your cup. So I really have great appreciation for the fullness and richness of life that we get to participate in.
That's good to hear. Rebecca, thanks a lot for taking the time to be with us today. It's been fun, and hopefully our listeners will have the same takeaway from listening to this episode.
Thank you, Fred. It's been a pleasure to be here today. Appreciate it.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.